own story.
Okay. Shlomo is in over there. He says, Rachok Masha Hayava Amok Amok Mi Yibsem. Chapter 7, verse 24. That's where I'm going to right now. Okay. And there's a very famous pasuk coming up. I just want to show it to you right now. That's the pasuk right before this one, where it says, look at the words just before we start reading pasuk Chaf Dalet. It's Amarti ech kema. Amarti ech kema. That's the end of pasuk Chaf Gimel. Vehi rechoka mimeni. I'm trying to just be wise, make wisdom of myself. Vehi rechoka mimeni.
Carbohydrates per ounce.
You're not counting them, are you?
A month of making me younger.
Can you pass down that water over there? No, that one. Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm wasting your tape here. We have to go back to the ship.
Oh, okay.
Pause.
Thank you. I'm ready to partake.
Joseph, this is for you.
Oh. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I could do without that.
Oh, he mixed it with one part the drink and four parts water, and you got some. Oh yeah. Okay, Chevra. There's a Gemara in the Sefer Yuma that darshens this pasuk. You got it on the Parah Aduma. Now, you know what the point is: that there are some things that will defy logic, that don't make sense. And basically, the point that Shlomo is trying to make, remember last week when I spoke about wisdom, literature is the height of wisdom from a Jewish standpoint, is to accept that we don't have all the answers. Gracious Chochma Yiras Hashem. Ezu Chochma Lameid Mikol Adam. That's the mission of Jerky Avos. You can learn from your own mistakes, from other people's mistakes. Don't be so arrogant as to think that Chochma has all the answers. Try to think of the societies that felt that Chochma had the answers, starting with ancient Greeks, all the way down to the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, where human achievement can reach a utopian level. Human achievement alone has often led to the most disastrous of human activities.
Can't base a society on rationality alone.
Correct.
There has to be an irrational basis to the rational and to the irrational.
There you go. An irrational basis to the rational, which is revelation. Because revelation, certainly from our standpoint, is not necessarily rational. It's not provable. Right? Okay. We often, you know, speak of tradition. I believe in the revelation because my father told me. And you know what comes before that, all the way back to the one who was standing there. It also helps that, you know, I'm sure you've heard this argument before, that according to our tradition, our revelation was experienced and witnessed by many, many people. Right? It's hard to pull a hoax on many, many people. Right? It's, you know, you can take a choice, few people, people will all agree that let's just make sure that whenever someone asks, we'll say that we saw the body rise from the grave, or we saw the horse being hitched up to the rocks at the top of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or something like that, and we'll perpetuate the tradition. It's quite a different thing when something is purported to have been witnessed by hundreds of thousands of people. Okay, so the fact that this pasuk Chav Gimel Chav Dalet is darshan on the Parah Adum, I just want to speak a little bit what we did last week. Remember, I told you at the end of last class about Rabbi Eliezer and his deathbed. What is it about the Parah Adum that defies logic? What's so strange? Correct. The Gemara says the paradox of the Chidalet Maseches Yuma, that what makes someone tahor, right? I'm Tomei, and you're the Tohar Kohen, and you sprinkle something on me to make me Tohar, and you become Tomei as a result. You become impure in the act of making me pure. That doesn't make sense at all. So, physiologically, it may make sense that, let's say, a doctor who administers a very serious drug, a chemotherapy, to a patient that needs it, if the doctor would be exposed to it himself.
I've got stories of here to show somebody who got stuck by a needle.
Yeah, while he was trying to help someone else, yeah. He was, by the way, he was found to be okay. It took him a few years to find out, by the way, to be rid of the fear of having AIDS. He was stuck by a needle accidentally. Anyway, the point is that what makes one person well might make a well person to be quite sick. So physiologically, we may be able to understand it, but I'm not sure if that's really what the issue is. And if you don't mind, I'm taking a slight tangent, 5 or 10 minutes away from Koheles, to try to give explanation to what Arthur said before about the irrational within the rational. And Soloveitchik has written very much about this. It's one of the main points about the halachic man to have this appreciation, and this is where it is. The Parah Aduma is that I'll take it from Rashi's standpoint. There's a mitzvah that defies all logic. It doesn't make sense why this law about if it has to be perfectly red and if there are two black hairs and all the minutia of Maseches Parah just defies logic. There's something you could do to explain all other Maseches, but Maseches Parah is off the charts. So after saying that, Rashi says that's why the Torah calls it Chuzos Chukas HaTorah, because it's a chok, Ein Lecha Reshus Laharher Achareha. And then, you ever see what Rashi does in Parshas Chukas? For about 10 psukim, after explaining to us how much this mitzvah defies logic, Rashi goes on to explain every single aspect, down to the hyssop, down to the brush, down to the whatever is mixed in, down to the water, down to the sprinkling, in terms of a reason, which is, anyone remember? Rashi says that every single aspect of Parah Aduma serves as atonement for Chet HaEgel. Sin of the golden calf, right? So every little thing the Torah told us to do, that refers to that in Parshas Kisisa, that refers to that in Parshas, that refers to that story, that refers to that, and all over Rashi does that. So Rashi, make up your mind. The way you're explaining it, it has explanation. It's meant to refer to a particular event in Jewish history, and that's what it's all about. What's so hard for us to understand about that? In other words, the question of Rashi is, why do you start off saying that Parah Aduma lacks any rational explanation, and then you go on to try to explain it? Right.
Well, is his explanation an assertion or a true explanation?
It's hard to totally be sure of an answer to that question. If you do talk about the methodology of Rashi and the way he writes midrashim of that sort, I can tell you that there's a dispute in the commentaries of Rashi. Some say he only writes that when he's sure that that's the explanation. And two, a direction I tend to lean towards. Which I tend to lead, is that she wrote it with the understanding that it's very possible that Pshat might be something else than this drash. But the question I ask is as follows. After the golden calf was made, there was a terrible plague, a scourge on Israel, where 3,000 people died. Moshe took the calf, he ground it into dust, gave everybody to drink, and it killed 3,000 people. Does it stand to reason, I ask you, that those 3,000 did something a lot worse than everyone else? Right? That they did not die at just at random. That there weren't some people who just got away with it. That if Moshe gave them to drink and it killed 3 and it didn't kill 30,000, it killed 300,000, it killed 3,000, that these 3,000 did something a lot worse than the others. Which amounts to a very small percentage of the people in Holland.
Why do we have to say that? Because I thought we just said the Mashkis, once it's unleashed, doesn't matter if Tzadik and Rasha are both included in it. So in other words, to say that.
Okay.
But this wasn't supernatural Mashkis. This wasn't like a human being.
I mean, this is Hashem going straight in there and...
Because who's for God, Moshe? Moshe says who's for God.
I hear what you're getting. Is it possible that someone got away with it? You want to say yes? I mean, I can't believe that someone who didn't worship the Egel at all and was trying to get people not to, don't do this, this is the wrong thing, drank that and suffered. You ready to accept that?
Probably not, but... I mean, just from what we've...
Well, it's a terrible thing to see someone in the desert watching his brother be killed after taking that potion, knowing that he was trying to get people to stop doing this.
Right, but so did Kor.
Spread that word.
Yeah, of course.
Kor also tried to stop them from sinning in the wilderness.
Yeah, but he was killed by the people. That's the mashkes you're talking about. That's perfectly fits with what you're talking about. When you're talking about a direct punishment, but Moshe says, let's figure out who did this, and he gives them to drink...
What was the Korban Bayis? I mean, everyone who allegedly was killed in the Korban Bayis had something to do with the Sinam or the other.
That's very different. You don't have prophets then, but here, what God says, tells Moshe, listen, grind this to dust, and we're gonna figure out who did what. I mean, it would be.
Okay.
I'm just saying that.
How did God know?
But I think the effect on the people of seeing...
Well, what about the first Korban Bayis? When that occurred?
That is a mashkes that comes, and the Babylonians are mashkes, and they're
right,
just doing to conquer everywhere they go. And they
right.
They didn't ask who was filming today when right. that went out. So anyway, so let me just get to the point of the whole thing. Is that although this they gave them to drink, and they all... It did its job of punishing those who deserve punishment. Right after it says they drank, Hashem tells them, "Atem chatasem chata ogidola. You've sinned a great sin, and you always will need atonement for this sin." And that's what Yom Kippur is. The question I want to ask at this point is, why does the Egel still need kapara if the 3,000 worshippers died already?
Right.
Memory.
He gave them. He gave them the cup. He gave them the atonement. You're finished. So what do we even need Yom Kippur on the anniversary on the 10th of Tishrei?
Never to forget. Memory is important.
Okay. And I'd like to suggest the following, and this goes back to what we said last week about Rabbi Eliezer and the four people who never sinned, remember that? Is that the real sin of the golden calf is not what we think. The real sin of the golden calf is not that people worship the golden calf. It's that only a few thousand worshipped it, and the vast majority let them, and didn't do anything about it. Didn't care to try to influence them one way or the other. They just said, I'm not going to get involved, let them just go. That's why Hashem tells the survivors, you've sinned a great sin. Their silence was their sin. Which only goes to show, silence is not always golden. Sometimes silence is the golden calf.
That's why Aaron didn't say anything. It would have killed him.
Right, okay, good.
So what was he supposed to do?
I mean that's one and economy. That's how a mob mentality works. Each person was saying, oh, "I'm not going to do anything with," so that 3,000 can set the agenda for 3 million. That can happen. Don't be so amazed. Ramban says, "I can't believe Rashi's pshat in the sale of Yosef because the way Rashi sets it up, Yosef had more friends than enemies. Reuben was his friend." Don and Naphtali, God and Asher was his friend. He's his friend, of course. He says he had more friends than enemies. Ramban, excuse me, you can have 2 who want to do the wrong thing and 10 who want to do the right thing and still the wrong thing is going to get done. It's just a matter of who's standing one, who's being more vocal. And the wrong people tend to be more vocal. Yes.
Was there anybody who tried to get people not to do it?
Yeah, there's one that we mentioned in the Medrash says Chur. The Chur tried to stand up, And they killed him right away. And that set the record straight for everyone else. So who's going to have worse in the future? Right, now Aaron Bayar is... Yeah.
And I'm forgetting my facts. When Bnei Levi are rallied by...
Now Moshe's down the mountain already. Moshe's back in charge.
Now Bnei Levi go out and kill the couple. So who'd they kill? Another 3,000, and I forgot the sort of the...
There are more than 3,000 altogether, but
okay.
But we want to say that...
In other words, it wasn't in the hundreds of thousands.
Right, it wasn't at random.
Okay.
So here's the point I want to make. Get back down to things. Is that Rashi, by telling us that the golden calf still needs kapara after all this time, what is that? The paraduma, right?
The red heifer
which we purify the death defilement. So Rashi is telling us why does the egel still need kapara? Why? Because of the secret of paraduma. Because everyone is going to say, not in my backyard. I'm not going to make you tahor, and I get tummy for that. That's your problem, pal. Don't get tummy the next time. Why shouldn't every Jew say that? The fact that the Torah commands some people to make themselves tummy in the effect of making someone else tahor, right, is why the egel still needs kapara. Otherwise, the egel's kapara was finished. Everyone who worshipped was done. There's a total kapara for the egel, but that's not the sin of the egel. The sin of the egel is not that we have to atone for every year on Yom Kippur. It's nothing to do with the worship of the egel. It has to do with the vast majority of Jews who didn't bother trying to do anything about it. Right? So when Rashi first tells you, paraduma defies logic, what is that? How can you command people to make themselves tummy? Everyone is going to say, not me. I'm going to stay home. I'm not going to sprinkle that water. Right? You following? So that's why Rashi is perfectly consistent, first saying that paraduma defies logic, and then explaining it in light of the ego. That is what it is about the paraduma that defies logic. That aspect that the ego still needs kapara, whether in Yom Kippur or as the paraduma.
Can he institute then Rashi's on?
How it relates to this. This makes no sense. Beautiful medrash that says that Moshe figured out the secret of paraduma through nevuah, through ahava, through love, through unselfishness. Moshe figured out what is the secret of paraduma, but not through chokhmah. You know why? Because it doesn't make sense. Okay. The point of this book is very valuable point is that as wise as this man is, and the author is, he is smart enough to recognize that there are limits to Chochmah. There may not be limits to Nebuah, but there are limits to Chochmah. And this sounds very Socratic at this point. If you've read Plato's Republic, or you've read some of Socrates' dialogues, you see that he feels he's smarter than all the others, not because he knows more than they do, but because he knows how limited his logic is, but all the others with whom he dialogues think themselves so smart. Okay? So, let's continue, please. We're up to Pasuk Chaf Hei. Okay. Chaf Hei is Sabosi ani b'libi. He's putting his chachma to some other pursuits. Right? Sabosi ani b'libi l'da'as v'lasur uvakesh chachma b'cheshbon. I'm looking for all kinds of cheshbonos. Right? And again, if any philosophy majors here, or Plato readers, or okay. You have some of his, let's say the definition of virtue. Right? I'm not sure if virtue is the best English translation of what he's looking for there, but whether it's the interests of the stronger, whether it's making people think that you're virtuous, right? He's saying of all these cheshbonos to me make no sense, which is exactly Socrates' conclusion. He says because a human being is not capable of defining pure virtue. which is what is going on in academia today. So, but Kohelet doesn't stop there. The Jewish tradition is, you're right, the human being cannot determine virtue. We have to leave that in our irrational to a higher revelatory order. You following this? And in that revelatory order, we have very, very careful, I mean, that's one of the gifts of the Torah, is to tell us there is pure evil out there. You cannot just say it's relative. Right? Well, you know, to Amalek, this is what's proper. To Nazi Germany, this is okay. And to this, and then we can have a discussion on euthanasia, and we can have a discussion on this. And not so simple. Right? Okay. So, there was some observant Jews that President Bush had on his commission of... one of the Jews just resigned, but Leon Kass, you know, his daughter used to daven here. Yeah, I wouldn't say he's observant, but his daughter's from. His daughter married Mandelbaum, you know. Judah Mandelbaum, right. So, anyway, I think they made Aliyah since then. But I've heard him speak, and he's very, very, very careful with this runaway. I mean, if you think that these various stem cells are going to be so helpful to us, be careful where you're running away with these things right now, he's saying. We're just at the beginning of it. Let's not rush. You know, that's all they're saying. And yet there is a big, there's all politics, of course. Mm-hmm. But what Kohelet is trying to say here is that the human production is capable of so much. Just have to be careful where it takes us. And just remember, and I use a Gumpian kind of statement, you're only as smart as the things you do. Right? Stupid as a stupid does. You know what I'm saying? There's some very smart people who do stupid things.
Handsome is as handsome does.
Oh, that too? Okay.
Well, that was the term that he used in the movie.
Really?
Why can't you say it? The person is as smart as the things he doesn't do.
Okay, the things he has discretion not to do, yes. Person is as mighty.
Who controls?
Right, is as mighty. That's more safer Mishlei. To be in control is really what safer Mishlei is about. But in economy, it comes across here. And you'll forgive, I have to beg forgiveness from half of the people who are in this room now for where Kohelet takes us now. If you know what I'm talking about. All right, what do we do with this? I mean, in Sefer Mishlei, the woman is so, so praised and exalted. And in Sefer Kohelet, the woman is...
Yeah, but there are two types of women in Mishlei, right?
Yes, chapter 7 does have the other kind of woman, too. But the one that comes through more, at least because we sing about her more often, and the book ends with that. I care about how a book ends. Yeah, chapter 31. But Kohelet now speaks about the Isha Ra, right? So you know what? You'll forgive me. I don't want to belabor it. This man has much too many wives. There is no question that every single one of them is nagging him every single day of his life, every single minute of every day, trying to convince him that the next king should be their son, right? So he reacts to that. What can I say?
But also that later on in the book, yeah. That he repeats is like, you know, the things about the good life, and it's like, you know, being with the
yes,
wife.
Yes, be happy with the wife. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Gemeshes bachurusach or something like that. Yes. All right, so you'll forgive me. I'm just going to excuse the. It's not that I'm wimping out, although it seems that I am. But Chav Zayin and Chav Ches. I'm just explaining away as the desperate reflections of a jaded man.
Not too many wives,
not
too many mother-in-laws.
Right, okay.
Did he ever sing
Yisrael? That's the Simchan Gan
Eden. Did he ever sing Yisrael to his
wife? I assume he probably sang it too many times. I don't know. Actually, as I've told you many times, Yisrael was originally sung in the book of Mishlei. Take a look in the book. It says to whom he's singing, to his... mother. Not his wife. He thinks it's his mother. And the king's name is Lemuel, whose mother advises him, now that he's in charge and in really he's such a perfect specimen of humanity. Basically, what chapter 31 is about is an advice from a motherly figure to anybody who has successfully incorporated the first 30 chapters into a life, you know, a way of life.
In fairness, right? Shlomo, weren't these marriages really political?
I should think so. It didn't stop whatever happened, but I should think so.
And what was at stake?
This was really his way of being the son-in-law of every king, so he doesn't fight in wars, at least until the very end.
So he's really complaining about the bitter politics that's all this involved.
And possibly. But the women were behind it. Well, there's no question. If you look in the Book of Kings, in Melachim Aleph, Perikid Aleph, Yudbeis, it says his wives taunted him and teased him into building. That's the kind way of reading it. He didn't do it himself, but that the women coerced him into building this idolatrous shrine. Okay. All right, so Levadra Eze Matzasi Asher Asohar Elokim Es Adam Yashar Vehema Bikshu Chishbanos Rabim. I say that man, if given instruction based on what God gave him, can end up leading a straight path. And yet they look to Chishbanos Rabim. They look for all kinds of the Chishbanos. Whenever I see the word Chishbanos, I think of Plato's dialogues. Of human beings, a bunch of human beings together, sitting around, sipping coffee in the Schwitz house, debating what a piece of work is man, and they all but Socrates, all of them think that they have all the answers, and Socrates shoots them all down, and he's as wise as with the same kind of wisdom that appears at the end of this parak, that man has no business thinking that he can figure out all his cheshbonos. Important word here is the word Yashar. It's a beautiful word. A very, very famous Netziv to Nakdama to Sefer Bereishis. You know what I'm talking about? Where he discusses that to be a Yashar is better than to be a Tzaddik. It's better than to be a Chassid. Just strive to be a Yashar. Straight person upon whom people can rely. Who doesn't make judgments. You know, he says that's what Bereishis is called Sefer Yashar. And he's very critical of the tzaddikim of his time period, who are critical of other Jews if they don't resemble them, things like that. If you ever have a chance, the Netziv, I'm starting chapter 8 right now, the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Berlin, was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volar Jnei Yeshiva, he wrote this, I don't know if it's translated anywhere, I've never seen it translated, but it's just such a... It's just such an excellent introduction about what it means to be a Yashrus person, a Yashar. Again, the Dhamma of the Netziv, the Sefer Bereishis. Okay, let's go to chapter 8, please. Mi kei chacham umi yodea peisher davar. Chachmas adam to'ir panav ve'oz panav yishuneh. Okay, yishuneh is a little difficult word here. It seems to be misspelled a little bit, but... All right, but let's see what he's talking about. What is a peisher? What is a pshara?
Compromise.
Right, it's a compromise, right? Okay. So,
Peisher. Explanation. Doesn't Peisher also come
from... Yeah, Pitron Davar Satum. Okay. Funny thing is that the word Peisher is, or Pitron, is only used in Tanakh. Very rare word. I'll tell you, Ibn Ezra uses it very often in his commentary as an explanation. He calls his explanations Pitron. It might have been a little arrogant because Pitron is a very specialized word in Tanakh to describe the explanation of a dream. A dream.
Yeah.
So that's only how it's the only way it's used. Explanation of a dream. Okay, fair enough. Certainly, Pitron or Peisher. But one thing is for sure,
extension
of a dream. One thing is clear is that in the biblical times, and certainly in Talmudic times as well, to be able to explain dreams was a very, very, very great high degree of chokhmah.
Yeah.
To see the inner moving, inner thought processes and the moving of the brain. Right? Now there's probably a tremendous amount of research on this, yes.
Small piece of triviality. In Harry Potter, one of the strongest spells that Harry was able to do was with Patronus.
Patronus, that's interesting. I have no doubt that knowing the kinds of verbiage that she uses,
well,
that
Petronius is an in that tablet is an emanation which represents the person, the inner person.
Like
Petronius is the he was making a protective shield against it. But Petronius is the creature that brings all these negative memories back.
But it represents the okay. inner
right,
self.
Right.
Yeah. Like all
right, which is what happens in the dream, which is proof that whoever wrote the Rowling, J.K. Rowling, whatever her name is, read Coelho's, of course. Okay, so.
What's the most important thing in the books? A kiddish cup. Just think about it.
A kiddish cup.
The competition, and the award at the competition is K-I-D-D.
Oh,
but it's a
Kiddish
cup.
Kiddish.
Kiddish. Kiddish. Kiddish.
There's
a Kiddish. Oh,
Kiddish. Kiddish.
There's a Kiddish cup.
Okay.
Fascinating.
That's the highest.
Is she Jewish?
Highest thing that person should see.
Okay.
Is she Jewish?
That's Avra Kedavra. I will create as I say.
Right.
Okay. All right, we'll write an article about this something. And send it to the Jewish press. Okay, so
that's how they're translating it. Who knows what things mean.
Wow. That's too simplistic, if you ask me. But anyway,
so what would be a good translation?
Peshadavar is I think a resolution.
Pesher is a deep meaning.
Well, pshara is a common terminology.
No, but pshara is
my poshrim is what?
No, but
what's my poshrim? Lukewarm water, because it's a compromise between the hot and the cold, right? But anyway, it's I think that you ever hear of Solomonic wisdom? When do we call in Solomonic wisdom? To make a compromise between two different positions, right?
It has to be clever compromise.
Right. So just split the field. That'll make a compromise. That's often impetuous. Right? Okay. So if you have true chokhmas adam, the name of a book, of course, as you know, true chokhmah of a person will open up his eyes, right? Now it says, "Oh, the oz panav yishune." Right? Now this is not a kriuksiv because it should be with a hay. That happens quite often enough in the Bible where olives and hays interchange. It's not a classical kriuksiv. You don't see another word on the side because the aleph and the hay are pronounced the same. Kriuksiv is only when there's a change in pronunciation, you know. All right, so. Okay, oz panav yishuneh means face will change. There's a strength of his face will change. Right? Chokhmah can be recognized on a person's face. Okay. Well, let's read around a little here. Aviva, would you do the honors here on Pasuk Beis? Ani?
Ani ti melech shemar ba'al divrash shivlach.
All right. Well, he seems to be paralleling the king with God here. Is that proper? I will observe the word of the king and keep my oath to God. All right, I think that what he's getting into here is the social contract that this author believes the people must sign with their kings in order to have a just society. Have you heard of this? The Morad B'Malchus is a Jewish concept. Although not based on Psukim in the Torah, right? But it's certainly in the Talmud, we do have a concept that the people admit that their lives are in the king's hands. Not that he can just commit murder at will, right? But if the king tells you to do something and you don't, he has the right to, you forfeit your life to him. It's an interesting thing that the Jews would allow. What righteous king would do such a thing? And the Hanami. David, you see, someone throws stones at him and curses him, and people say, let's separate him from his head. And David says, no, I deserve this. Now, we hope that when you finish the Plato's Republic and you see the description of the philosopher king, of which you might be familiar, you hope that a Jewish king behaves in this kind of way, right, an enlightened way. But, there is a pasuk initially, Yirah Elokim Beni Vamelech, fear God, my son, and the king.
Well, you know, in David,
well, later on, yeah, he gets even at the end. But at the time, you know, he would have been within his rights to say, you know, to treat me like this while I'm down, you know, and to get him. But he doesn't. Okay. All right, so I have a list of psukim here in Mishnah that give a similar juxtaposition of God and the king, but just be aware that while we may have a more enlightened picture of what a king ought to be today, the Jewish idea of kingship is similar to, although let me just qualify this very carefully and clearly, is that one of the deciding features of the David and Bathsheba story, I think I might have expressed this to you once before, that we should take, when people say, oh, what a terrible, miserable thing he did, how could he behave this way? At this time in history, if a king takes a married woman, no one's going to accuse him. The king does this with impunity. The most important part of the story that we should take historically is that the king allows himself to have the finger pointed at him, and he reacts and says, I've sinned, I've done a terrible thing, I'm waiting for your punishment. The prophet has his way with the king. No other society has that. Right? And there might have been some power struggles between some kings and some popes. But I think of some kings of England created new institutions because they wanted to show that they had their power over the popes, right? Whether it was because they wanted to marry or divorce or other things like that. But usually, I mean, look, this concept exists a lot within Chazal, whether Yiftach or Pinchas has the upper hand, or whether Eliyahu or Ahav has the upper hand. There was a struggle between the political leader and the religious leader, let's say. And the fact that the political leader, the king, David, allows himself to be rebuked and shamed, as it were, by the religious leader, and he accepts it, is really one of the most defining parts of the story. I don't mean to sweep under the carpet what David did in that story, but I got to tell you, lots of kings are doing that kind of thing then with impunity. Okay. Clear? Okay.
We're not talking about Monica Lewinsky.
No.
I mean, it sounds a little bit familiar, a little bit similar to King Arthur and the whole sort of episode that preceded sort of the birth of King Arthur, as well. There's a rape, and there's a king that, you know, sort of was able to get through, and Merlin granted him that, and then Merlin says, you know, you can't do this, and you know, you're supposed to let the army retreat, and instead, you know, the father of King Arthur killed sort of the legend. Father of King. I mean, it gets a little convoluted, but suffice it to say that it has a little bit of that, and obviously it's probably taken off as...
Right, this myth is... Right, because David was also from a stock that is questionable, quite questionable. We did this earlier in chapter 3 and 4, where we talked about the king that didn't start off as a king and was a fugitive and wasn't accepted. And then, right, instead it's either David taking over from Shaul or Yeravam taking over from Shlomo. Okay, Al tibahel mipanav telech, al tamod b'davar ra, kol asher yachpotz yaseh. This is the advice he's giving, is that, you know, whatever the king wants to do, he'll do. Right? Just like whatever Hashem wants to do, he'll do. So don't be so quick to get on the bad side. Asher dvar melech shilton, umi yomar lo ma ta'aseh. The king is in charge. Right? Who's going to tell him what to do? Right? Okay, now, Shlomo means obviously God here. I don't need to, he's talking about, well, the human king will do whatever he wants, don't get on his bad side. We're talking about God here. You know, in the end, don't pretend to be able to have a say in what's supposed to happen in this world. Right? And, you know, since there's so much that can change on the swat of a fly, on the slightest inch of, you know, so much changes on these little things, right? That can drive you to be jealous and vengeful and vindictive and despise your lot at every moment, right? Or we can just stop blaming the king for this and just get on with your life. Because there's more to it than that, as Pasuk Hay says. Shomer mitzvah, lo yeda davar ra. How about if we turn around, Johnny, we always come back this way, maybe we'll come out the other side. Johnny, would you read Hay?
Shomer mitzvah, lo yeda davar ra,
chapter 8, verse 5. I would like to concentrate here on he's trying to say lo yeda davar ra. Now, is that a guarantee? Come on, what is he saying? Shomer mitzvah will never know something wrong. I know lots of shomer mitzvahs that I know, and others that I should have met that I never had a chance to meet, who knew plenty of bad, plenty of evil. Right? So what guarantee are you giving me here? The eis mishpat yeda lev chacham. The wise heart will know a good time for judgment. Well, I always stand weary of these kind of guarantees. Right? We talked about the Lo Yitzi Tzadik Ne'ezov last week, remember? I mean, we have to be very careful of human beings being so sure and making guarantees. I always, when I write a letter for someone who just did a great chesed, I never write something like, God will give you. I always say God ought to give you. You know, God should give you. People, you know, I send them checks and I send them stuff, and he goes, the bidachasana, God will give you all the shefa. How do you know? I don't mind if you say God ought to. I have some ideas of what God ought to do too. But don't be so arrogant as to say what God will do. If even want to say God should, that's also okay. All right, so on the way here, I just came back from a wedding. We were talking about people who see certain events take place, and they say, "Oh, see, that's happening because da 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 da." Right? Remember, there was a Friday night attack at a disco in Tel Aviv. So the Haredi world was saying, "See what happens when you go to discos on Friday nights."
But what happened to the attack?
Be very careful.
Mosei Shabbos.
2 weeks later, on Mosei Shabbos, right after Abdullah made a shiur, it was terrible. So be very, very careful. Who knows what Hashem is doing and who's on that? But he's saying, what is he? Shomer mitzvah lo yeda davar ra. So clearly, Shlomo cannot be so oblivious to the fact that before him and after him, lots of shomer mitzvahs have known davar ra. So you have to qualify this and explain it. Is Johnny you're trying to do?
I was thinking of maybe taking a different interpretation. Like, in other words, instead of saying like that we're talking about, let's say the word of God is in it right here, maybe still that it's talking about the king. So in other words, Shomer Mitzvah of the king, you know, a human king, so Yehuda Devar Ra, like, in other words, being consistent with, hey, you know, you'll stay out of the king's, as you said, the king sometimes has arbitrary sort of justice on his side. So, you know, if you do what the king wants, you know, you won't sort of cross that line of the king. I mean, I don't know if it sort of fits in with what we just said.
Right.
If you kind of follow that fit. Idea, it's like, you know, do what the king says, you know, justice in its time will be done. Right? That's what he's saying.
It's talking about more, it's not talking about what's going to happen to the person. It's more how the person thinks, like the way the person thinks.
Of course. You cannot think that. Just you do the right thing. You do the mitzvah, whether it's what the king wants or just the right thing. Mitzvah here is defined as the right thing, then don't think in terms of, oh goodness, see what I did, if I had not worn that tefillin and I would have gone before and I didn't daven today, then I would have made it there in time before that thing happened. Don't think that way. You cannot think in terms of, I mean, Yosef, while being sent to jail, probably thought, as he 10 minutes before he's about to meet the butler and the baker, he's saying, what an idiot I am. I could have given in to Potiphar's wife, maybe even had a good time while doing it, I don't know, but I could have given in to Potiphar's wife and stayed in jail. What an idiot. Right? No, that's not Yosef. Yosef says, listen, if staying with Potiphar's wife is the wrong thing to do, then I'm not going to pontificate how I got to jail for doing the right thing. Right? It's part of something. That's wisdom. Right? I have to do the right thing. And I'm not going to second guess doing the right thing, even though it seems that an immediate reaction to doing the right thing is something bad that happened to me here.
Yeah, so right? So really the sentence, if you read the sentence as an entire,
yeah,
as an entirety, is saying, it's actually very similar to Plato, which is that a person who's wise and who has the temperament of obeying laws, is lawful in their disposition, knows no evil. That means that they accept what happened.
What an irony of the way of his demise.
Yeah.
Because that Plato's demise came for violating the law, right? So not being shomer the mitzvah, and right, but he did so fully understanding.
Yeah, but Socrates in the Apology says that he's urged to escape, and he refuses. He says, because I have to show people that I'm lawful.
That would break the law.
I have to accept the verdict.
Right.
Because I fundamentally, the lesson I bring to people is that you'd be lawful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just that the wise mind will know time and justice. In other words, be patient. And, you know.
Had he escaped, people, we probably wouldn't know him.
Right.
Because they killed him that he became so famous.
He said, "How the laws are my father and my mother. Yeah. How can I be betraying my family?"
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so we see the word the mitzvah here is very well rounded.
Bad and good are never really explained correctly.
Okay, bad and good is
the terms that are used, like
right. There's an eitz hadaat tov v'ra. But here he just says, he doesn't say any relative judgments. He just says, you do the mitzvah. You just do the commanded thing, as if though that's something on the books or something that's known. And notice also it says shomer mitzvah. It's not just oseh mitzvah.
The good, the good, the bad are specifically pointed out. But what are they? What's good? What's bad?
Well, I mean, even in the Torah it says do the right thing. The Torah
right.
Is not...
Not right. Good. Bad.
Good thing.
Those
I think
are never really...
I look in the beginning of the Torah. The Torah uses... God uses the word good a lot. And the first time that the word good is used by a person is where Chava looks at the tree and sees, oh, kitov ha'etz l'machol. To me, this looks good. Now, she's determining that it's good. So human beings also want to get in on it, right? The determination
looks good.
Right. We're not supposed to be denied a decision making. God didn't want to keep us from knowing between good and evil. That's what we're here for. But man, what Chava wanted from eating from the tree was precisely what we're talking about here.
Knowledge of good and bad.
Right, to be the decider of good and bad. That's why when we venture Rosh Chodesh, we say, V'male mishalos libenu l'tova, amen selva. It's a beautiful sentence. It doesn't mean, she said, V'male mishalos libenu, give us whatever we want, God, because I know what I want.
We don't.
Hashem, V'male mishalos libenu, please God, make it be for your definition of good, and we'll work with that.
The word.
Okay.
Developed in such different
so, the reason to for the exhortation to behave this way is because ki l'chol chevetz yesh esu mishpat v'asa adam rabba olav. Be very careful. Right? As Rashi says, she'adam oseh chefetzo v'over al das yesh es lihipara mishpatu paranut mochenet. This is a very, very upbeat statement here Rashi is trying to make for Kohelis. Is that, and if people have been suffering, I dare say probably more people have suffered in human history than have had a good and productive life. I mean, in this world today, the majority of the 6 billion people in the world don't have a wonderful life. Right?
The vast majority.
Really, that's the vast majority.
Well, you don't have material wealth.
Not just material wealth, but fear of a repressive government. That's, I mean, I'm talking about China, or maybe, you know, there are many, many people in India, and there are billions of people in these places, between these places. So what Rashi is saying is that recompense catches up with everybody. Now, sometimes it takes longer than other times, but recompense catches up with everybody. So that's why it's better. Better to be, you know, this good thing here, right? Ki ra'asa adam rabba olav. Says man is capable of a lot of evil, but it all catches up on him. Ki einenu yodea ma shiyeh, ki kasher yiyeh miyagid lo. Who knows what's going to happen at the end? You can set up all the safeguards, and then you think it's going to be a 1,000-year reich, and then whatever it is, right? But it's not. You know, you can make all the plans in the world, right?
It harkens back to a Greek proverb: "Don't count any man happy until the day of his death."
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can you say that in Greek? Thrasymachus.
Common,
yeah. No.
I'm just giving a nice Greek name.
Thrasymachus.
Perspicacious.
I know. Okay.
Thrasymachus
is the mate. It might make right in the dialogue, yes, indeed. Yes, okay. So, Ein Adam Shalit Baruach. How about, Kathy, would you read Pasuk Ches? Okay. Around the room?
Shilton, Biyom, Hamaves, Yen, Mishrachat, Samil, Kama, Velo, Yimalet, Risha, Es, Ba'alav.
It's coincidental that you should get such a pasuk immediately after saying that Greek, proverb. It says here, V'ein Shilton, Biyom, Hamaves, V'ein Mishlachas, Ba'mil, Kama. We're talking about a certain type of war here, a certain type of battle, right? That what Rashi wants to say is that there's a certain battle we have to do in our lives, and we're not free from fighting that battle, right? I mean, in the ancient tone beyond our mothers, we have to fight a battle to the death. Because you never know where you're going to turn, you never know what's going to happen, especially now that we're living so much longer, and who knows how we need to prepare for that long life in ways that we never thought of before. There are all kinds of indignities that can come to us in old age that we never even think of. It's very possible that when those indignities come, we don't really care about that. We just want to survive, you know. But still, nonetheless, these battles that we fight, this shilton that we want to have, we want to be in charge, right? We don't want to be burdens on our children. We don't want to be right. You know, we want to be in charge of our situation, right?
I like the mishlachas comes in here. You don't see a mishlachas malachim roim. You don't see that kind of mishlachas thrown around.
Okay, so So mishlachas is Rashi says is to try to change your, you know, you have, you know, you try to buy yourself off of what you're doing. Let someone else do this, or let my son or my eved take my place, or something like that. You can't do that at that time. Remember the Twilight Zone episode where that very wealthy guy gets 50 people and each buys a year from him? Right? He buys a year from them, basically. And slowly he's getting younger and younger and younger. You don't know what I'm talking about?
No, I didn't see
it. No one watches Twilight Zone?
No.
That one? What?
How
did it end?
Can't
see it.
Can't do that, though.
In the end, I think he bought too many of them. Something like that. I don't know. Came too immature or something, I don't know, but anyway, obviously he's saying that it comes a time, the Ein Mishlachas, that battle you have to do yourself. You can't get someone to fight that battle for you of staying straight your whole life, alright? You really can't, you can't put it off to your children, you can't put it off to your anyone else. It's a very private thing, you can't put it off to your spouse either. In the end, you got to look in the mirror and you got to make that battle yourself. And I've been saying all along, and it's a Shomer Mitzvah, I've told you so many times, is the discipline of saying, I can do this. I can say, we let ourselves go in so many ways. Right? You let yourself go when you know you shouldn't be eating this and this. And that. You know, you go to a wedding and you see it's all over the place, you go to a dinner, and you know you shouldn't be eating it. But if that was a treif dinner, if that was a treif dinner and you were invited by the firm to a treif hotel and it was really beautiful food all around with you'd be able to control yourself, wouldn't you? Because the religious impulse is very strong, but the impulse to eat healthy or things like that is not so strong. Why the Rabbanim? I mean, guys come to collect tzedakah from Israel all the time and they reek of cigarette smoke. I started telling them, I'm not giving you tzedakah so you can buy more cigarettes to kill yourself. Money is fungible. If I give you $1,000 so you can send your kid to school, but you're spending $10 to $15 a week for cigarettes, what good is that? Right? You have an answer?
Yeah, my dad had a story about that because he was around in Saratoga, and people used to come to him, they'd off all their money at the racetrack, and he used to go to the bus depot and buy them a car. And he said eventually these guys at the bus depot said, I have to tell you, these guys are cashing in their tickets and going back to the track.
Ouch.
Ouch.
Yeah, a guy who recently told me he went to Atlantic City in a $50,000 Mercedes and he went home in a $90,000 bus. Made some money. So anyway, so but in the Hanami, you have these all these problems. Anyway, what I tell them is that if you can be in such control to study Torah and to observe the mitzvahs, how come you're not in control of being able to stop smoking? You know it's killing you. If you want to, take a look at Mishle Perek Lamed Aleph, where the woman comes to tell her son about being in control. And she talks to him about things that you put in your body, she talks about drink and other things, that will be coercive. You know, I can be in control and say, okay, no more pomegranate juice. You tell me it's time, I'm not going to have some. I probably will, by the way, but they meant it. But some people are just, they want it so much, it's impossible for them not to, they get crazy if they can't have it. Many people I know work in emergency rooms and say, you know, I've seen people come in and they say, if you have another drink, your liver is going to disintegrate. And they're in the emergency room the next night from drinking too much. Right? So, right. Well, anyway, that is the this battle that hopefully we need to discipline ourselves from our youth. There are clearly some oh my goodness. There are clearly, ouch.
What is it?
This is antioxidant rich juice. Always wearing some juice that has dietary fiber. So. Oh, we have to go. We have to do Gemara. Okay.
Told us that.
Chevra, next Monday night, Emir Tashem, I plan to be having a barbecue on the mountains of Yehuda, overseeing the Dead Sea, having a little festival. So, my plan
is have a wonderful trip.
Although you will probably be in your office at work at that time.
We're going there.
I'm going Wednesday night in Mr. Shem to meet my daughter, my granddaughter.
Oh, you said you're having a barbecue.
Monday, yeah, we're doing something in the desert, and at night, at the end of the program, they're doing some kind of, in Shomron, kind of barbecue on the mountaintop.
Monday, you want to be here?
I'll show you some pictures. So I will not be here a week from tonight. Mr. Shem, 2 weeks from tonight, I'll be back.
You won't be here Monday.
I won't be in there.